You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Welcome to the after-lunch breakout panel. I'm Ligia Ricciardi. I'm going to be moderating your panel today, which is on health information technology and the top five ways that Congress can save healthcare through technology. Before we jump in, though, I think it would be really helpful if we, myself and the panelists here, can get a sense of who's in the audience. So I'm just going to ask you a few quick poll questions. First of all, congressional or Hill staffers? Okay, excellent. What about private sector folks? All right. Are NGOs not covered? Okay, excellent. And for how many of you is healthcare the primary area that you work in as opposed to, you know, technology or other general policy? Really, only one or two? Okay, a few. All right, excellent. So again, I'm Ligia Ricciardi. I have a consulting practice which focuses on health information technology. It's called Clear Voice Consulting, and I work on health IT policy and implementation issues. We have a pretty exciting panel today here. I am going to give the panelists a chance to introduce themselves in just a moment, but I want to let you guys know, as will become evident, they don't have prepared remarks. The idea here is to have an open conversation, and the way we're going to do that is I'm going to ask a few questions of the panel, and then you'll have a chance to ask them some questions as well. Before we sort of jump into the meat of the discussion, I wanted to share a little bit about how I actually spent my last week and how that brings home the importance of these health information technology issues to me personally. So I spent my week really in two ways. One was with a lot of really sporadic and not very effective interactions with the health system. And the second was watching a lot of Disney movies, neither of which I would really recommend, neither of which I had particularly intended. But I have a three-year-old, and on Tuesday I got a call from her daycare saying, "Got to pick her up immediately. She has pink eye." Pink eye is really contagious, as some of you may know. It's also called conjunctivitis. It is fairly easy to diagnose. It's fairly disgusting. It's not particularly life-threatening. But, you know, I'd seen it before. I picked her up. I called her pediatrician. I said, "She's got pink eye. Can you prescribe something?" And he said, "Oh, no, of course not. You know, got to bring her in, got to bring her into the office." So I rushed in, you know, pouring rain, traffic, craziness, screaming child, got her in, and he said, "Oh, yes, it's pink eye," immediately. "Okay, great. So can you prescribe something?" "Yeah, sure." So he did, except that it was the wrong thing. So several days later, there we are watching the Disney movies. We're on our second course of medication. Point was, it wasn't pretty. She's now okay, we move on, but a lot of time was lost, and there was a lot of sort of frustration and at least moderate level suffering. And I'm talking about the Disney movies, not the eye. Obviously, this could have been a lot better in a fully networked health environment. For one thing, it would have been great if we could have done the diagnosis perhaps through, you know, a camera on my phone so that I could have just sent it in and the doctor could have said, "Yes, pink eye, you're right." It would have been great if he could have used e-prescribing to send in prescriptions. Even better if he'd had an electronic medical record that had traced her history here, looked at her allergies, and helped actually choose the right medication, make sure the dosage was correct. Even better if I'd had a personal health record so that I could have traced some of my experience in, you know, treating this disease in her, not only in the past, but in the present, and sort of said, "Well, it's not responding," and got an immediate back and forth via email. So these are some examples of, you know, why it's really important to focus on health IT. Obviously, we're not even talking here about the broader issues of kind of life savings and vast cost savings that would be associated with revamping our network, but we're talking about day-to-day frustrations and loss that average Americans are experiencing all the time and that create a lot of hidden costs, lost work, lost time, suffering, that kind of thing. For those of us who've, you know, been working in the health IT area, health IT has really been, you know, the next big thing for about what, 20 years now? but I am hopeful that this time it actually is different, in part because of the economic situation that our country finds itself in, which puts enormous pressures on healthcare reform. I'm also helpful because of course, a lot of the talk that we've heard not only from the incoming administration but from Congress about a real willingness to make a change here, the $50 billion pledge over 5 years by the Obama campaign, and possibly a lot of money coming into health IT in the very short term through the stimulus package. So it doesn't matter to me whether we end this panel with exactly five recommendations for Congress, but what I'd like each of us to try to do is to try to tease out the most important issues that need to be dealt with in the very short term and unpack them a little bit to give some direction to some of the folks, particularly congressional staffers in the room. So with that, I'd like our panelists each to do a brief introduction to themselves. David Lansky, do you want to start off?
Good afternoon, everyone. David Lansky, Pacific Business Group on Health. Is this on? Doesn't sound very on. Can you hear in the back?
Can you guys hear?
Yeah, okay. PBGH is our shorthand, is a coalition of large employers, all of whom have a large California presence. It's been around for 20 years. In general, this group works together to improve the quality and affordability of healthcare, both in California and inevitably nationally. So our interest in these topics today is very high. We really believe in the sectors my employers work in. We have companies like Chevron, the State of California, Safeway, Target, Wells Fargo. Every one of those organizations has been transformed by technology and has felt it a routine requirement to deploy technology to improve the quality and efficiency of its services. And it is paradoxical and troubling for my members that the healthcare industry has not made a similar commitment to transformation. So I'll give some thoughts as to how I think. Do you want to talk about the congressional approach now or when we come back around?
I would, if you could wait for just a second so we can hear who the other folks are.
I'm Devin McGraw. I'm the director of the Health Privacy Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology. The Health Privacy Project has been around for many years and was an independent organization for a long time and actively engaged in debates on health privacy when we were talking about health information on paper or being submitted electronically as part of an insurance claim. CDT, on the other hand, has been very active in the internet space and in particular dealing with consumer privacy on the internet. So it was a very happy marriage of the two organizations that allows me to leverage the technology expertise at CDT to provide recommendations on health privacy and security protections so that we can get all the benefits that we want from health IT and build public trust in these systems.
Hi, I'm George Scriven. I'm a senior global strategist with Microsoft's Health Solutions Group. Specifically, I focus on our consumer health platform, consumer personal health information platform, Health Vault. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Health Vault is it's an online service provided by Microsoft that lets consumers collect, store, and share personal health information. It allows families to keep all of their health information in a single place, and it provides interfaces that allow third parties to write applications that can communicate with Health Vault. Basically, that allows independent companies, whether they're hospitals or healthcare companies or even entrepreneurial organizations, to deliver services over the internet to you to do things like manage conditions or achieve a fitness goal or a weight loss goal. So we're really excited about the prospect of actually being able to do more stuff with your personal health information online and receive guidance in your own home as opposed to having to have frequent and sporadic interactions with the healthcare system.
Hi, I'm Steve Waldron. I work for the American Academy of Family Physicians. We're a membership organization of family physicians with about 95,000 members. Of those, about 62,000 are actively practicing here in the U.S. And since about 1999, we've been very aggressive in trying to get our members to adopt health information technology. In 2003, we started the Center for Health Information Technology, which I currently direct. And from 2003 to 2009, we've increased the adoption rate of our membership from about 10% in 2003 to about 45-50% now in 2009, I guess it is now, isn't it? And we can talk further about, you know, what that means, because you'll see other statistics out there. The adoption rate is around 24, and I think it goes back to what was discussed earlier about the kind of the patient experience, and it's really about automating my practice. It's not about providing high quality care, and it's not about making convenient care currently the way the system's set up today.
Thank you all. I think what I'd like to do is ask a few targeted questions of the individuals on the panel, and then you will have a chance to sort of fill in if there are any particular issues that I haven't asked you about, and then we'll move it over to general questions from the audience. So I wanted to start with a question specifically for Dr. Waldron, which is about this idea of funding infrastructure for health information technology. And there's certainly been a lot of discussion at this conference of broadband in the health, you know, broadband internet service. In the healthcare context, infrastructure certainly can, in some discussions, include electronic medical records, software, a whole variety of different things. I guess I'd like to ask two things. Number one, should Congress be focusing on building out particular types of infrastructure, one or another category or type, more than others? And secondly, what sort of requirements or ties might be associated with infrastructure build out?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I mean, the broadband, there's been a lot of discussion at this conference, and healthcare, just like other you know, industries, would create a lot of value out of having broadband, especially in the rural areas where a lot of our physicians practice. So I think broadband is kind of a no-brainer that we need to drive that infrastructure, especially around the ability to do telemedicine. I think there's some issues that we could do around legislation, and that the laws around where I can practice and how I can practice vary by state, so I have to be licensed in every state. So if I sit on the border of Kansas and my patient is in Missouri, can I do telemedicine across the state line? So there's some issues there, but again, I think broadband is definitely something that we need to drive forward and can get value. I like the symmetrical piece to that that people have been talking about here. In regards to build out, I think the government should be involved. There's definitely a public good to driving this technology. In regards to the type, though, I think the main thing is we need to get the providers that are providing the healthcare connected with technology. And it's really this issue of a chicken and egg. Do you build a network to make sure and get all the information into the practice so that when I put in electronic health record in my office, on day one, I have access to the patient's claims data, I have access to their lab data, I have access to their medication history that as they fulfilled it at Walgreens, again, with the right privacy constraints that is controlled by the patient, then I have a significant amount of value to that technology on day one. If I don't have that connectivity, then I need to add all that information into the system before I getting a significant return on investment. So I do think a network, looking at networks is important. I think looking at more regional, more of affinity networks where patients are being shared currently today. But I think, again, pushing the adoption of the technology, and you talked about and asked about requirements. And I think what we have to do in healthcare is really decide that we need to change payment reform and actually pay for the things that we want so that we pay for that convenience, we pay for that quality. If we put in proxies like we've done in healthcare, trying to slide down the cost by either controlling the number of units that we produce or the cost, people in healthcare are very good about playing the game, and they will play the game with health information technology. So I think we need to focus on those requirements of continuity, coordination of care, quality reporting, performance measurement, and focusing on those type of things to deploy the technology in these practices, as opposed to saying that they have to have a particular technology or they have to have a particularly certified product.
Dr. Alansky, I see you nodding your head.
I like what you said.
You're agreeing. Do you have any sort of elaborating thoughts on particularly what types of technology or infrastructure investments Congress should be making?
I would say in general, we at least don't feel very prescriptive about the types of infrastructure products. And as you said at his last comment, saying that an EHR, an electronic health record of whatever specification, is the thing we want to pay for, or that a regional health information exchange of a certain design is what we want to pay for, it feels like this is too immature of a field to overspecify at the federal level what the networks and products should be. Instead, I think consistent with what you've said, the incentives, if they were properly established and aligned, would create, like in other industries, motivation on the part of healthcare professionals and providers to buy technologies, invest in technologies, which would drive improvement toward maximizing those incentives. And so particularly if the incentives are for the kinds of things Steve mentioned, care coordination, mm-hmm. achieving good outcomes for patients, moving information to where it can be used, deployed. For example, now a lot of the emphasis has been on information technology instead of on information. And if instead we said to doctors and others, you'll get paid more if you use information when you write a prescription, if you've looked for the medication history for that patient, as in your daughter's example, if you've looked for whether the drug you're prescribing has an interaction with another drug, if you've done these things which improve quality and safety, that's going to improve your payment. You can find the technology and the methodology that's going to do that the best. If it's a cloud-based, PDA-based, EHR-based, e-prescribing-based, I, as a purchaser, don't care what platform you use. I care that you deliver high-quality, safe care. So I would like to reward you when you do that and not reward you when you don't. So there are hundreds of examples where information that could be deployed to improve care isn't being deployed. Mm-hmm. And I hope we can create incentives in payment reform that will drive everybody in those directions.
Thanks. I'd actually like to shift gears a little bit to look at a different aspect of this issue. As you know, there are a lot of concerns in a world of expanding communications and sharing of data about privacy. We heard a panel on that earlier this morning. But I think those are particularly acute in the health realm, where sharing or missharing information can have huge ramifications. So I was wondering if I could ask you, Ms. McGraw, if you had any thoughts on what Congress should do to best address some of these patient trust issues. And or I shouldn't say should do. I mean, I don't want to assume that Congress should necessarily do anything. So maybe I should open it that way. But thoughts?
Sure. No, I don't have anything to say on that topic, Legia. Thanks for asking anyway. You know, first of all, when you say the word privacy and people either say, oh, yeah, we need it to move this forward. We know that. In fact, you'll see very few documents out there or oral statements from policymakers where they're talking about health IT where they don't say in almost the same breath with appropriate protections for privacy and security or with privacy and security. So one would think that you know, this should be actually relatively easy since everybody agrees that we need it. But of course, the devil is in the details, and so the other reaction you get when you say you're here to talk about privacy protections for health information online is people, you know, looking at you like deer in the headlights and can't get out of the room fast enough because the issues are not necessarily easy to resolve. One piece of advice that I would give to Congress is to approach this issue from a comprehensive policy framework as opposed to a kind of a one-size-fits-all solution that we think is going to work in every single context. And I'll give you an example. The rules that we need to put in place for how healthcare providers exchange information via electronic medical records, in my view, need to be very different from the rules that will need to be put in place, for example, when you're talking about personal products that the consumer, that are designed for the consumer to use to get the consumer more engaged in their own healthcare, like the Health Vault product from Microsoft. And what I mean by a framework is really a set of rules about who can access information and for what purposes and that are enforced. We have federal health privacy rules in HIPAA. But those were really enacted not necessarily to govern just a paper-based world, but to govern sort of almost one, I call them one-off transactions or one-to-one transactions where you're talking about the submission of an electronic claim and also the movement of paper, where it goes from one place or the other. Now we're talking about a world where we're digitally connecting people so that information can be accessed through the National Health Information Network or through a regional health information organization. This sort of where it can be accessed more easily, and that is mostly a good story for patients because as Ligia pointed out for her example, and as Dr. Waldron pointed out, and as Dr. Lansky pointed out, we want information to be moved for healthcare purposes. You want your doctor to have the information about you so he or she can make the right diagnostic decision and not give you a medication that you're allergic to. On the other hand, the fact that this information is more accessible for good purposes means that it's potentially more accessible for bad. So in my view, we need a clear set of rules that are contextual, that meet the particular risks or threats that are posed by the different technologies, and that allow, again, allow information to move for good without having it accessible for bad. Now, drawing those lines, not always an easy thing. But I think if you approach it from that standpoint, much better off than saying, well, here's the rule, and it's supposed to apply across the board.
Okay, I'm wondering if I could ask George Scriven from Microsoft to follow up a little bit about, you know, if we sort of, I don't know if you agree with Devin's approach about this overall framework approach, what's the role of the private sector? Where are sort of the lines between how much Congress delineates what you need to do and to what extent you take your own, you know, responsibility for creating privacy practices?
Right. So just from the perspective of Microsoft and our experience with HealthVault, you know, we're well aware of the paramount importance user trust has in the uptake and acceptance of something like HealthVault. And Google knows the same thing, and, you know, they're taking the same approach with Google Health Dossier. Anybody else that's sort of in our space puts privacy front and center and user control front and center if they're, you know, at all mindful of what they're doing. So from our perspective, our incentives are to protect and to act very aggressively on behalf of the consumer are pretty clear and well aligned for us.
Mm-hmm.
If the consumer does not feel that they're in control of their personal health information, they're simply not going to adopt a personal health information platform like HealthVault. So in terms of kind of guidance, advice, and experience that we can offer, all we can say is that if you have to conceive of the protections primarily putting yourself in the place of the user, right? You have to conceive of these protections primarily from the perspective of what would you want, how much control would you want over your personal health information in a service that is supposed to be the safe place where you can put it. And I think that tends to draw a lot of answers for you, right? It tends to prescribe the solutions for you, and kind of hand in glove with user control is transparency. One of the key elements in the design of HealthVault, and one of the things that I think really resonates well with our users and with the advocates that we talk to, is that, you know, within HealthVault, there's never really any question as to what's happening with your information. And that's kind of unique, actually. Given all the places where your health information is, there are very few other resources where, as an individual, you can actually see the information as it exists and understand everything that's happened to it. Mm-hmm. With HealthVault, you know all of the applications that you've used, whether it's, you know, the Heart 360 application from the American Heart Association. You know that it has access to your blood pressure measurements, and because you authorized it. You can see all of the various transactions. But that's not really the case with health information systems elsewhere. So increasing the level of transparency is critical to increasing the, you know, user acceptance and trust.
Thanks. I wanted to ask actually a sort of a general question about all of this, which is open to any of the panelists. Obviously, we're dealing with health information, which is incredibly valuable and incredibly sensitive. We're also dealing with potentially really vast quantities, sums of money over the next couple of years being invested in this area. How can we make sure, how should Congress make sure that there is adequate oversight? You know, you're talking, George, about transparency, mm-hmm. so the public can see what's going on, but what mechanisms should Congress be looking at to make sure that, in fact, what is happening in you know, the health IT sector is what we want to be happening? And anyone who's, it looks like you... David,
do
you have a thought on that?
I do. One or two. By the way, a couple of us have left papers up on the tables near the doors, and the one that we put there describes a multi-stage stimulus funding approach to IT that we think would address actually this issue among others. So one of the accountability or transparency issues with federal spending is, does, like we just saw with the, you know, the bank recovery program, does the money we intend to spend to achieve a certain strategy and outcome actually get spent that way? And so in the case of stimulus for health information technology that is now on the table, it's a real concern for my folks that we could spend $10 billion or $20 billion a year, buy a lot of computers, plug in a lot of computers, run a lot of cable, and doctors would still practice medicine the same old way. They would just have a better filing system. how do we know that once they've installed maybe a very capable system that could do lots of great things, they actually use those capabilities to deliver better care? Fortunately, if they are connected to the internet, it is conceivable that they could be effectively audited electronically to see that they are deploying the capabilities that are possible with this new technology. So for us, part of the payment model should be to split payment from upfront incentives for purchase and deployment, coupled with accountability for actual use a year and 2 years later. That the incentive payments, like in the e-prescribing bill that's part of the Medicare reforms, that the payments create an incentive for actually using the technology and an auditability that they're actually using the technology for the intended purposes. So that's one level is really almost an audit level of accountability. The second on transparency and governance is we have a proliferation in the last 5 years or so of quasi-federal, quasi-private agencies which have de facto taken on the responsibility for setting standards and deciding on technology strategies for the federal government that are a little shaky. And it is time, I think, and whether you know, Senator Daschle's proposals for the health fed go forward or not, there does need to be a fresh look at governance at a national level where it is not the industry leadership who defines what the public interest is, but that the public interest advocates can define what the public interest is. So the idea of the health fed, and certainly Daschle argues this very well in his book, there needs to be some mechanism, including in this space of quality and IT, where the standards and performance requirements are set in the public interest, and we resist the temptations of industry capture, which sometimes take over this kind of process.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Before I turn it over to the floor for your questions, I had one question which I particularly wanted to give to Dr. Waldron, although others are free to weigh in as well. There was an Institute of Medicine report which was released about a week ago, which said that, quote, current efforts aimed at the nationwide deployment of healthcare IT will not be sufficient to achieve the vision that we all have and may even set back the cause if they continue as is. So pretty strong words from the Institute of Medicine, and their primary recommendation coming out of that report was actually about providing cognitive support for healthcare providers and for patients too, designing systems that help you make sense of all the data that you're going to get, all the additional information that comes through, you know, greater connectivity. And I guess I was wondering, first of all, would you agree with that? And secondly, do you think that, again, there's any role for Congress to take in making sure that that kind of capability is built into tools that physicians and patients are going to be using?
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much agree with that assessment. I think the cost, though, is really an opportunistic cost of saying if we spent the, you know, X, put the number there, billion dollars on health IT to lay the landlines, to put in the EHRs, and really focus just on the technology and not on how it's actually going to be used and what the outcomes are, then, yeah, we could have spent that money on doing things that actually did move payment reform forward, that did move quality and accountability and continuity forward. So I think that's the risk. I think that the way health IT is today, I think it still adds value to the healthcare system. When I talked with the numbers earlier when I did my introduction of the 40 to 45% of our members that are putting in health IT, what they're doing is they're putting in health IT to lower their overhead and to look for additional revenue sources. So they're looking at automating their practice. If you look at the functionalities that they're employing, remote access to the record, so I'm at home or I'm on the football field with my son, I can pull up somebody's record because I'm on call. I don't have to go in and do that. So those type of things. Now, if you look at quality-based decision support, saying how are my diabetics doing, which diabetics mm-hmm. should I really focus on and reach out to, that functionality is not being used today because there's no incentive. Mm-hmm. Again, going back to you know your opening comments, the pediatrician that saw your daughter, now if I would have done that over Skype with the video thing saying, yep, that's what it is, I know you've got a good relationship, yeah, right. I'll write you some erythromycin just so there's not a secondary infection. It's more convenient for you, how about you pay me $25 for that so it's the same amount as a copay. It's quick, easy for me. That physician that saw your kid in the office probably got 80, $100 from your insurance company because,
right.
So again, it's the way the incentives are set up. So I think that's the issue. I think I also agree there's people like Peter Bash from the MedStar here in D.C. that always advocates that there's the potential of the technology adding new errors to the system. So going back to the e-prescribing, if this pick list is real small and it's hard for me to pick one or the other and I pick the one medication just below, the system already goes back and says, oh, I know this drug is a 50 milligram, that's all it's given in, and it's a once-a-day drug, that's what the recommended dose is, and you normally get 30 of those for a 30-day supply. When the pharmacist sees a script, looks really, really valid. If I would have handwritten that, they'd have said, wait a minute, this drug doesn't come in 10 milligrams. There's something wrong. I need to pull that up. So I think we have to look at those things as well.
Mm-hmm. Devin?
I think the other thing that we need to pay some attention to is the role that consumers and patients will play in a digital integrated healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
I think in line with interconnecting providers and making sure that claims get to payers more efficiently so they can be paid, all of that is very important to patients as well. But to the extent that we are asking patients or inviting patients or we want patients to be more engaged in their own healthcare, particularly with respect to chronic conditions where self-care mm-hmm. is such a critical piece of staying well, staying productive in the workforce, these tools really need to have interconnectivity with patients. So whether it's through the type of service that Health Vault provides or through what's often called a patient portal, which is a patient's password-protected, secure way of looking into portions of the medical record or scheduling appointments online or doing secure email transactions with physicians. A lot of what I've seen come out of the process that's been in place so far to try to roll this out has been very much almost singularly focused on what do we do to make sure that providers get this information and can talk to one another versus what are we doing to create a system that is more patient-centered and where the patients are more involved, and how can we engage them?
I would agree. If I can ask you a follow-up question, I do think patient access is incredibly important in this area because this is about not just sort of transforming the healthcare practice but about really bringing people fundamentally into the center of the, health relationship, taking some greater responsibility for their own care. This issue of consumer access is a really important one. Obviously, there are companies, including Microsoft, that are building external tools to that, but one may or may not have direct links to one's provider through that. Devin, do you or any of you actually think that Congress needs to take action in order to encourage or force this patient direct access issue at all? And if so, what do we need to do?
Well, I'm not sure whether it's Congress, but I certainly think government.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's Congress or whether it's HHS has a role to play in making, again, setting the priorities for how the standards get rolled out that everyone is going to need to adhere to the extent that we continue to use certification as a way of making sure that people have a product mm-hmm. that is interoperable, putting as a priority the patient, evolving us to a patient-centered healthcare system through these technologies that provide so much potential to do that, I think is something that, again, Congress and the agency should focus on as there is, mm-hmm. sort of rolled out a strategy that I hope will be a better and more focused strategy for getting us to the place where we want to be. Patients have the right under federal law to get a copy of their healthcare records under HIPAA, so that applies to HIPAA-covered entities, but it's just saying that you have the right to get it doesn't mean that the entity's always going to be comfortable with sending it directly to a PHR or mm-hmm. another service provider or a health record bank for that matter. So, and how much is that going to cost? Right now, actually, to get a copy of your record can be quite expensive because it has to be copied, it has to be amassed, there's labor right. costs and copying costs associated with it. Well, when those go down, do we have the policy infrastructure in place to make sure if it's not free that we're talking about a nominal cost? I mean, ideally, this stuff should all be very easy and almost transparent, very transparent, of course, but almost automatic. And we're not there yet, but I'd like, we should get there, and we may need some help from policymakers to do that.
We Would you guys agree? David, do you agree?
I just want to emphasize that point. I think it should be more than, it should be mandatory mm-hmm. that the provider receive my health information, that they have temporary stewardship of it, but they don't own it, and they have an obligation to provide it to me in a form that I can make use of it, whether I want it to be on Microsoft or Google or some other platform or on a piece of paper in my office. One of the things we suggest in here is that any new federal money around health IT, if it's going to be used for electronic health records, it should require that the provider make available to the patient an electronic copy of that information in a format that they can make use of. So I think it should be an obligation of anyone receiving any federal funding for healthcare and any Medicare provider to make my data available to me in a form I can take advantage of. Part of what we need to move toward is a more disruptive environment, as we heard from the Skype presentation over the last 10 years in that industry. Once the information is liberated, all kinds of innovative services are possible. And if the information remains in the custody of the traditional providers, they don't really have any incentive right now to innovate and respond mm-hmm. to your original scenario. So I hope Congress or other agencies, as Devin said, will make this an absolute expectation that my data is available to me in electronic format.
I would expand and not just single out providers, but say that anybody that has health information,
right.
mm-hmm. so health plans, and I mean, sometimes in my physicians have difficulty time getting a lab company mm-hmm. to get it in a reasonable format to them, so they couldn't provide it to you as a patient. So I just expand that, but I agree.
Yeah.
So having some experience at shaking digital information loose from people who have it about you, what we found actually is that providers line up reasonably readily to give patients access to their information. Plans, even plans do, because their incentives, particularly on the payer side, their incentives are in having you engaged with your health information or on the basis of your health information and doing something about it, living healthier, you know, living cheaper, being a cheaper covered member. It's no coincidence that, you know, both Aetna and Kaiser have elected to make your records available through Health Vault out of their consumer-facing patient portals or member portals. The real difficulty, though, gets when you get that to that tier below the very large institutions with mm-hmm. physicians who are practicing digital medicine. And that's sort of the unique wrinkle of the American healthcare system. I'm a Canadian citizen, so I'm somewhat familiar with the same problem elsewhere, but, you know, the problem is the 80% of physicians that don't practice digital medicine in any way, shape, or form. And what is their incentive to adopt the kind of systems that can actually maintain meaningful health records about you? And I think ultimately if there are levers that, you know, you can throw through regulation or legislation, it would be at the front end. Mm-hmm. I think there's a willingness and awareness among consumers to take control of their personal health information, particularly among moms who coordinate care across their entire families, are beginning to coordinate care not only for their kids but for their aging parents who may or may not live in the same place. Like information, it's an information problem for them, and they know it. Mm-hmm. And they want the information, and they want to have all the facts present so that they can protect their families. And physicians and pharmacies, pharmacy benefits managers, plans are more or less over the past year we've seen them get in line with the idea of liberating that information. To greater and lesser degrees, but ultimately it comes down to how do we make this pervasive below the tier of the large institutions.
Right. I'd like to take a moment to turn the floor over to you guys and see if anybody's got any questions. If you do, please feel free to come up to the mic and ask our panel anything you're curious about.
My experience has been that no one has questions in the healthcare space. They just trust us to do this.
Hi, I'm Julie Rones, and I am a member of Congressman Ed Towns' staff. And we were very happy last year in terms of the House in passing health information technology legislation. And we hope to see that pass this year, and excited that the Senate is taking up the measure. I guess in a hearing soon. Some of the things that I guess we are excited about health information technology and e-prescribing is that it is supposed to make medical care safer, more immediate care through remote opportunities and improve the quality of care. And it really has the ability to establish prevention in terms of use of standards to capture information. And I guess my question really goes to that issue of prevention and use of standards and how the panel might feel about that. Because one of the concerns that we have is being able to capture de-identified data that's individualized and mass data so that we can kind of capture for bioterrorism reasons and pandemic purposes and also for you know, different ethnicities and minorities for minority health disparities. And so it's kind of important to us, Mr. Towns in particular, that de-identified data be captured. And we see a lot of opportunity in standard setting that can capture that and wondered if there's some kind of view on that. Thank you.
I mean, I guess I can start. I mean, we appreciate all the work that Congressman has done on health IT and look forward to, you know, continue to work with your organization to continue to move, you know, health IT legislation forward. I think standards, in my view, what we've done is we've used standards as the proxy and said that, oh, well, the reason that we don't have health IT and we're really not doing this interoperability is because we don't have standards. Well, now it's the fact that, oh, now we have too many standards. So we have 3,000 or 5,000 healthcare standards, and I'm not joking about the number. That's exactly the number of health IT standards that we have. So we put together an infrastructure to say, what are the breakthrough use cases that we need? Let's harmonize those standards down to a list of, I think we're up to 160 or 170 now that Secretary Leavitt has you know, recognized. But the problem is that those standards are needed, and we have to have standards to move forward. But if we don't change the business and the processes and the reward system and the incentives, then we won't get the adoption of the standards. There's hardly any incentive for a physician in practice to put in highly structured, codified data beyond their use. So e-prescribing is definitely a thing that we've seen that there's a significant amount of value to a practice to automate that, move that forward, putting in a problem list of all your conditions and your allergies because the systems today do a pretty good job of, you know, checking those and managing those and making sure you got your E&M codes all done correctly based on your diagnoses. But as a physician, I get paid to see people come into my office. So anything that takes more time, again, decreases my volume or decreases the number of procedures that I do, it costs me money. And these systems cost money to put in, and it takes that time to enter those data. So again, if we change the paradigm and said, really need to focus on rewarding outcome, yes, I say it, penalizing bad performance for physicians, then I think the standards of which ones we need to pick, everybody will say, yep, that's the ones we need. Yes, we need to use those. And then the vendors and the community can actually add a significant amount of values. Again, I think it's focusing in on that what we want, the quality, the continuity, and mandating that and rewarding that and penalizing that as opposed to saying that we have to have standards. I think it'd be like looking back in, you know, the early days of the internet and say, okay, we need to standardize, so we're going to say Gopher is the protocol that we're going to use. I think that's where we're really at in health IT, and if we pick those particular standards, we may be hamstringing ourselves in the type of innovation that we really need moving forward.
Did anybody else? Okay. Dr. Lansky?
I absolutely agree again with Steve. I think it's unusual to see a case where the government needs to be setting standards for a large, complex industry like this. And, you know, you think of the music industry or banking industry, when the incentives were there, they figured out the standards pretty quickly, and those standards evolved to be responsive to the changing technologies over time. So all this hubbub about federal control of standards is a little peculiar, and mostly is going to reflect an advantage to incumbent companies that have a desire to see standards that support their current business strategies. We have to be very wary of that. The second thing I'd say, I absolutely agree with you and the Congressman's emphasis on public purposes of this infrastructure. We're going to spend a lot of money, federal public money, and whether through Medicare, FEHB, or DOD, or VA, or through the stimulus program. And it's important for the federal government to say, as the public steward,
we have other interests besides personal care, besides helping one patient and one doctor do a better job, which is very good. We have a public interest in public health, disease surveillance, bioterrorism, quality measurement and reporting, value purchasing, and so on and so forth. And if we're going to spend a lot of public money, we're going to insist that users of that money contribute to the public good in the way that Congress deems appropriate. So I think attaching those strings to federal investment in IT is extremely appropriate. And I'd mention that, as you know, that New York City has really been an exemplary implementation of HIT by having the public health department in the city of New York support individual doctors and safety net clinics and a variety of providers get online with this quid pro quo that they will be part of the public health strategy for New York City. And I think that's really been very well executed and a model we should all be looking at.
Did you want to add to that?
I think the only thing that I would add is from a privacy standpoint, we would actually advocate looking at more ways to push data that today can be used with fully identified data into realms where it is more anonymized, because while it's never completely risk-free, mm-hmm. you know, with each time you strip data out, you definitely minimize the risk to privacy. Having said that, I do know that we need to take a look at the current de-identification standard, because today, if information, it's a term of art under HIPAA, if it qualifies as de-identified, it's just out of protection at all, and there's no requirements with respect to how it gets used. The entities that receive it don't have to, it can be any entity at all. They don't have to enter into any data use agreements and commit, for example, not to re-identify it or post it on the web or hold it for, you know, a decade or two and then reconnect it up with mm-hmm. data later. So I think we need to look at that. I don't know. I wouldn't suggest stopping where we're going with that, because I do think the aggregated data, and again, the more that we can anonymize it and still make it useful for the legitimate purposes for which we want it to flow, the better off we'll be from a privacy standpoint. So, mm-hmm. but we need to look at that. And I know that that was actually part of the bill that passed the Energy and Commerce Committee last Congress.
Okay, we've got a number of questions here. Maybe the gentleman in the back, and then we'll...
Actually, I think she was before me.
Oh, okay.
Just a couple of things came to mind. I'm not in this field at all, but are there any pilot projects going on in medical schools or teaching hospitals? I mean, sort of a generational thing, you know, if the newly trained doctors are used to this and in time, you know. And the other is about the potential vendors for these services. I'm thinking, say, doctor's offices use, they seem to be pretty up on billing services, and then recently, you know, Blue Cross here went to Medco, and I'm just amazed, you know, I get this little email message to renew my prescription, and it's all online. So it seems to me in that medication pharmacy area, there's something going on. So those two vendors, you know, maybe could get interested.
One interesting phenomenon we've observed in terms of the uptake of digital medicine among doctors is you would think that the younger the doctor, the more technologically inclined that they would be. And in a sense, that's correct. However, the way the system's structured, they're also the most indebted ones looking for the most volume in their practices as they get started. Right, so they're the last people actually to invest in information technology that robs them of, you know, volume of business and volume of procedures and has high capital cost. If they're going to put money behind anything, it's going to be something they're compensated for. Weirdly enough, the doctors that are most interested, and I know this personally because my old pediatrician in from my kids back in New York, it was clear he had a giant three examining room practice. He was the only guy there. You know, and his wife ran the front of the house. Every computer was connected to the internet. You know, this was a practice where the costs were sunk a long, long time ago. So for him, it was, you know, it was just a matter of interest. He could do it almost as a hobby. He could automate and digitize his process and keep an electronic medical record for a solo practitioner. So, you know, once again, we keep on coming back to the way physicians have to run their businesses in small practices. It's not easy to implement IT.
Yeah, I'm agree with that. I mean, our study results of our members show that, I mean, there's no real stereotype. There is definitely a higher statistic of adoption of those out less or that have been out less than 15 years of residency, those that are not in a solo practice, those that are not in a rural area. So again, the physician that is going to be retiring in 5 years that's solo in a rural, he or she is not going to adopt this technology. But even the ones that are thinking about, retiring in 7 to 10 years, they're thinking about, if I'm going to sell my practice in 7 to 10 years, if I don't have an EMR in my practice, who's a new physician that's going to buy my practice from me if I don't already have that infrastructure in place?
Thanks. I think what we're going to do is take questions from the two gentlemen who are standing, and then we will give each of the panelists a moment to share any final thoughts. So I think you in the back really are at the front of the line now, so go ahead.
Thanks. Bob Kramer with the Computing Technology Industry Association. We're very much interested in the health IT. One of the reasons we're interested is we represent the groups of companies, small businesses that help install these systems in doctors' offices and health clinics, et cetera. And my question is to that, and is that I used to work for the banking industry, and you mentioned earlier the financial industry has installed business systems similar in nature, systems that talk to each other between banks, ATM systems, for example. But these systems grew up organically over time. And in fact, ATMs grew up over several decades before they actually started talking to each other over the entire country. We're talking about installing a national system over a very short period of time. And so has there been much discussion about what it is going to take to install, maintain, and train the users of these systems in terms of what kinds of resources are going to be allocated to do that? Both the terms of the software and perhaps the hardware to do that, both at the doctor's office level as well as clinics and hospitals.
Well, I can talk from the physician office side, and that is going to be a rate limiting step. If we are able to get significant amount of funds to put this technology in, you get the physicians ready to adopt this technology, it's going to be that deployment. Is going to be a huge issue, and that's where the success or failure is. It's not, which EMR did I pick? It's did I implement it correctly? I would point you toward AMIA, the American Medical Informatics Association, AMIA.org. They have some policy statements and things about workforce relative to medical informatics, but that is an issue, and we need. I've heard up to 200,000 new trained people to deploy these technologies. Just in the hospital side, nobody knows how much it would take in the ambulatory side.
Thanks.
This is a question from the personal side. My primary care doc has just joined MDVIP, which is one of the concierge medical chains, and he continues his individual practice, but he cuts it down from 3,000 patients to 600, and the theory is that each of us will be able to get much more of his time for paying a stiff annual retainer. And one of the things that he gets from the MDVIP mothership is all kinds of data retention, data analysis. I supposedly will get a little pocket-sized CD that I can carry around in my wallet. And I wonder if this kind of transition risks balkanization, where he joins one umbrella ship like MDVIP, and if some of my specialists join other chains, they may or may not be able to deal with what that's providing, and these may or may not be compatible with various standards that the industry may or may not provide, and they may or may not be compatible with what the government mandates. And so for a while, I'll have this little CD, but I wonder whether that will be an island of technology in a sea of other islands that don't talk to each other.
I would maintain that that's actually what you have right now. This can happen within an institution. There's a reason why the radiology department hands you your films and makes you walk down to orthopedics. It's because their systems don't communicate with one another. That's within a hospital, right? And you can imagine what happens with the rate of business change where individual institutions merge with one another over time. So you've got a single hospital that's built up this, balkanized system. Every ology has their own system that doesn't communicate with one another. Now you've scooped up the Presbyterians over here and the Methodists over there, and you've given yourself a new name and a new logo that's in green and blue. Pretty much you have one giant family of ologies that don't speak to one another. The good news is that, and I don't think the standard setting process has gotten us very far down the road of increasing interoperability. I think a reasonable analogy to draw is kind of like the internet. We could have, or the web. We could have waited until, you know, the semantic web is a really, really good, promising vision where every piece of information carries its own, you know, like semantic properties with it, so you know, you know, the information with that, what this chunk of information means within a context. We'd still be waiting for that if we were waiting for the standards around the semantic web to evolve before we actually implemented the web. We implemented a pretty dumb web that was brutal, but it worked. But the fact is that it unlocked a whole bunch of innovation, and we can iterate towards the semantic web. I think healthcare informatics is kind of the same way. We don't need to wait on standards bodies to finish their work and be complete before we start implementing stuff. These are bits. They're not railroads. They're not physical objects that need to be moved from one gauge to another. We know this for a fact within Health Vault. We jumped in kind of with both feet, maybe a little naively in terms of, well, it's just information. We can transform it. It comes with enough metadata. We can figure out how to get a piece of information out of a one document format into another document format. And the answer is, it can be done. I think the key driver there is when consumers demand that the information, that their providers give them their information so that they don't have to wait for a national health information network to coalesce before they get data portability. My personal example is that I moved from New York City to Redmond to join Microsoft, and I will be, and what I really needed was an NHIN that connected NYU Med Center, my pediatrician, to Overlake Hospital on the east side, and pediatric associates. I will be an old man before those points are connected top down, right? Or an older man before these points are connected top down. But with something like Health Vault or Google Health or Dossier, if I have all this stuff with me, I'm the network. I move it around me. And that's the nature of healthcare. It's very idiosyncratic. So if we're waiting for the top-down answer, it's going to end, standards-based top-down answer, it's going to be a long, long time.
Thank you. I did promise each of you a couple of moments for concluding thoughts, so really, truly, just a couple of moments. If we could start at the end with Dr. Waldron, and just any final thoughts you want to underscore, emphasize, bring up something we missed, but try and keep it short.
All right. Well, I'll just do my top five. I think the number one I've harped on the entire time here is payment reform. Focusing on continuity, care coordination, quality, and consumer engagement. I agree with you, Devin, on that. I think the other is access to capital. Cost is an issue. I like Dr. Lansky's discussion about do like we do in primary care in the state of Kansas. If I go to medical school, I can get a grant from the state of Kansas. If I go and practice in a rural area in Kansas, they'll pay back that. If I don't, then they start a high-interest loan from the first day I walked into medical school and rip me a new one that I have to pay back. I think we need to do the same thing with health IT. You put that we get you the money so you can put it in. If you don't get the outcomes that we want, you have to pay us back. I think access to quality and performance data collection, aggregation, analysis, having some kind of either regional or national infrastructure to be able to capture and analyze and aggregate quality data. I think being able to support innovation in the workflow and processes, what we don't want to do is galvanize our current systems. We really want to be able to say, how can we get innovation? Because we don't want to put an initial investment, and then that's all we get. We want to set the stage that the market can continue to iterate and move forward. And then I think the last one is going to your point. We still need to do a lot more education and training, both for clinicians to put in these systems, but also for the technologists that are going to be deploying these technologies across the U.S.
Thanks. I can't help interjecting that I think we also need consumer education. if we can move on to Microsoft.
So,
Mr. Scribner.
I would amplify those. I would amplify those comments only by adding that it's important to maintain, you know, when thinking about these investments and thinking about policy and what it could do to advance the cause of health IT. And all of the benefits that would engender, to maintain the consumer as the focus. Think of this from a citizen, patient, person, however you want to think of them, centric perspective. That will drive a lot of the privacy prescriptions, policy prescriptions around how to better create a health IT system that is actually oriented around the consumer, that allows for them to be more personally engaged with their health information. The point has been raised a couple of times that most, if not a the preponderance, most healthcare happens outside of your interactions with the healthcare system, particularly mm-hmm. for the expensive chronic conditions that we all live a long time with. As long as that's the case, there's a missing link between the consumer and the physician. The physician, well, the whole caregiving infrastructure, which is broader than physicians as well. So it's important to keep in mind the central, the kind of newly central role that the consumer mm-hmm. plays in healthcare.
Excellent. Ms. McGraw?
Thanks, Ligia. Rather than say what five are, because I couldn't come.
I said no big pressure on the five. The point is highlights.
You know, our sort of document describing our recommendations for what is needed is, again, by the door with documents from some other folks. But I'll say all of them can sort of be placed under the general rubric that if people don't trust these systems, whether it's some sort of personal record platform or electronic health records that are exchanged among healthcare entities, this will not happen. And part of building that trust is the right set of rules about how information can be shared and used. Again, building on what we've already got in HIPAA and filling the gaps, coming up with new protections where we're talking about entities that are not part of the traditional healthcare system, and enforcing all of those rules a lot better than we have.
Excellent. And Dr. Lansky?
Thanks. I would just remind us all that there's huge frustration with the very expensive healthcare system we have. The healthcare system already spends $2.4 trillion of our money every year. So it's not as if there's a lack of dollar resources in the system to do worthwhile things. So as we think about that, the idea of putting the patient or the consumer at the center of the rethinking of what healthcare is and creating incentives around the consumer's improved health and the ability of the consumer to be a linchpin of their own information in the way that several have described is a really important theme to keep coming back to. And be very wary about throwing more money at a system that just soaks up money, no matter how much we give it and increase it every year, it just absorbs money and still doesn't deliver the kind of quality that it's capable of. So dealing with those fundamental incentives is really paramount to any new investment in the healthcare system. So I think payment reform, as Steve has said, focus on encouraging innovation. We have a very static infrastructure and system for delivering medical care, and it's really one of the few sectors left that hasn't been challenged to redesign itself. So finding ways to use federal policy to use these new platforms, including consumer-facing platforms, to put the person, as in the Skype example, at the center of the network and let the rest of the professionals and services revolve around meeting consumer needs is really the opportunity we have. It's a really exciting opportunity of this next round of investment.
Thank you very much. Let's give a round of applause and thanks to our panel here.